Geekscape.com. Creed of a Fascist Revolutionary, Part 2. The definition has been attempted of the boundaries beyond which liberty shall hold no sovereign sway in the fascist state, the line of demarcation being always the spiritual and material welfare of our people. In the barren lands which lie on the wrong side of the line is likely to be found a remarkable assortment of individuals, all of them spiritually incapable of assimilating the ideal of the corporate life. That vere parfit Marxian knight, Vannoc II, with other top-heavy and humorless pedants, will doubtless spend his days exchanging reminiscences with James Douglas, Beaverbrook, and sad little Joad will make queer bedfellows. Only their common futility will explain the comradeship of Alan of Hertwood and Elias of Odoms, while the general population of this appalling desert will consist of all the aliens who supply the films with their slop and slush, all the nitwits who serve a debased press, all the architects and jerry-builders who have turned the fair face of England into a red rash of measles, the entire pageant of people who have had great opportunities and betrayed them for egotism or for gold. It is argued against us that in our arbitrary way we shall rob mankind of the services, here and there, of a great man. That is not our intention. Mankind is a large institution, and if any man has great services to offer for its advancement, he shall be tested by his willingness to apply his gifts to the task of enriching the life of that part of mankind which shares with him his nationhood. If charity begins at home, how much more so does necessity? So far from being ranged upon genius, fascism demands that genius shall come down to earth and range itself on the side of those who work for the common interests of all, mobilized so that it can help to give immediate direction to affairs. Thus the Bernard Shaw of the future will be neither suppressed nor ignored, nor treated as a buffoon. He will be used, his immense faculty for social criticism, meeting with speedy recognition, and contributing not only to the benefit of posterity, but to the solution of the practical problems of his own day. If our civilization is to be built up by deliberate effort and conscious planning, if our national life is to explore every possibility of splendid wayfaring, then we can afford no longer to spurn the cooperation of our great men. But on the other hand, the great men will be charged with the responsibility to see that their powers are used for the advancement of the corporate life of the nation, and not as explosives for blasting it to bits. Our opponents cry out against us that we are intolerant of criticism. That is untrue. The flexibility of the corporate state is devised for the purpose of making the maximum use of criticism, since it is only by such means that the dynamic urge of a nation towards great achievement can be maintained. Fascism's one stern condition is that the critic should know his job and pursue disinterestedly the ideal of the common good. We are intolerant of the criticism of the amateur and the fool, because wherever such criticism is heard, the chances are that the knave, the eternal racketeer, is standing close behind the curtain, full of glib whispers, using the critic as a tool wherewith to create division and strife so that he may plunder outside the confines of a planned economy among the ruins of empire. Such criticism we shall either destroy or divert into channels less socially dangerous. And here again, the admirable contrivances of the corporate state come to our aid. Fascism, deriding the lunatic notion of democracy, that your farm labourer is competent to pass an opinion about, let us say, the final snags of marine insurance, does insist that he is at least competent to pass an opinion about farm labouring, and therefore provides him with a scientific system whereby that opinion can find expression, no matter how mild or how devastating it may be. In this way, even the most insignificant individual will be able to contribute to the planning of the state. So infinitely complex is the organization of the modern state, that the menace of the amateur and the hack must be brought decisively to an end. Their place must be taken by the expert, not because the fashioning of a technician is the final objective of the creative force, but because the human experiment is doomed unless it can make secure the first objective, which is the establishment of a satisfactory basis for the provision of the material needs of life. Until this be done, the spirit of man lies in bondage to every kind of wretchedness and folly, from which it will be rescued only when every citizen turns technician in order to master his own particular job and correlate it to the work of the rest of the community. Unity today is not only strength, but the sheet anchor of survival. If we appear to destroy liberty, it should be remembered that the particular liberty we destroy is that which is destroying the race. In place of it, we offer to all men and women of goodwill the right to work with valour, not merely to keep the wolf from their own doors, but even more to build in Britain a corporate life that will finally triumph over the difficulties of the material world and set free the human personality for all the adventures that the spirit of man has yet to undertake. It shall be said of the fascist revolutionary that before transforming society, he transformed his own life. The miser may preach philanthropy and get away with it. The lecher may slink through the dark and yet wear the halo of his chapel or his church. But your social democrat cannot make fascism. Humbug commands all entrances but this. Fascism tolerates no whining about rights. The highest privilege it grants is the renunciation of rights, all but the right to serve, to suffer, to sacrifice. Indeed, says the social democrat, and is seen no more. We are as dry-eyed at his going as we shall be steely-eyed in the easier days when he begs leave to return. Those who serve fascism as revolutionaries must lay aside creature comforts and security. That is the least of the demands made upon them. Night after night shall they go forth to speak, or to protect those who speak, from the argument of broken bottles. Week after week shall they surrender themselves to routine, long after the novelty has worn thin. And much more shall they do before the hard-fought day is won. Life offers to men many pleasant diversions, many opportunities of escape from the harshness of fact, many subtle shades of experience, many bright colours, all of them. For the present, the fascist rejects, not because he is colourblind, not because he has a one-track mind, but because there is a revolution to be made. The foundations of life are threatened, and civilization in its crisis calls for decisions in black and white. There must be no posturings, no dawdling by the wayside. In these hard days of the battle for survival, there is more to be solved than crossword puzzles, pleasant fancies, daydreams, little oddities of knowledge, all the things which grace the observer pages. These are the tunes of those who fiddle while the soul of man burns at the stake. Poor fiddlers! They cannot see the conflagration, so enthralled are they by the music that they make, flaneurs as effective as butterflies in a gale. Fascist revolutionaries pick no flowers in these pretty fields. There is a job to be done. A transcends crossword puzzles and letters to the observer, a job that will not mark time while darts are thrown or philosophic hairs meticulously split, a job that dances no attendance upon art, criticism, or table tennis, and is independent of the results of the 3:30 or the panting of hounds in the wake of an electric hare. These things, no doubt, are good things. We adopt no moral attitude towards them. But we know the force of the gale that blows, and we have no time to spare, no surplus energy. Straight through the frills and furbelows of the times do we cut our path, and still our major sacrifice is not made. Wit shot with malice is enjoyed by men. It is pleasant to see the wind taken out of the sails of our colleagues, enjoyable to see them riddled with the rapiers of satire. They may be our friends, but the ego is appeased not less on that account, our puny ego, which seeks to loom immense above the diminished stature of the good fellows who are ranged upon one side. Here we approach our major sacrifice. We have learned to scorn these pleasures, to applaud the better phrase, the clever argument, to seek out the brilliance and the valour of our comrades, to resist the temptations, to exalt ourselves at their expense. The pampered ego is clamorous for recognition and quite unscrupulous. It is satisfied with its own appearances, careless of the facts which those appearances hide. Left to itself, it revels every hour in a riot of self-exhibition. And victory shall come to us, because by ruthless discipline we have resisted these pernicious pleasures and surrendered our ego utterly to the cause we serve. That is a measure of sacrifice we are proud to make. Even in these putrescent days of democracy's life in death, an emergency still has power to place the able man in charge. When a ship founders, or a building is ablaze, or panic overtakes a body of troops in action, the duly constituted authority acts peremptorily and finds himself obeyed. Or if the authority be incompetent to deal with the crisis, then a natural leader almost always arises in his default to take command. The skipper whose ship is sinking does not wireless Whitehall for instructions. The chief of a fire brigade does not demand a royal commission to decide which windows of a blazing building shall first be smashed. The subaltern, in charge of badly shaken troops, does not telephone for advice to the war cabinet. And if the subaltern and his non-coms are shot down, it will be a poor platoon that cannot produce an able private to take charge. Even in that most important department of imperial life known as sport, the principle of leadership is still retained, at any rate, in so far as the captain in the field is enabled to change the bowling without calling the selection committee together or getting in touch with the secretary for the dominions. Recent tendencies show that this principle is weakening, and that one day we may see Mr. J. H. Thomas, in the cause of imperial unity, vigorously tic-tacking from the grandstand instructions to the captain as to what form of bowling our Dominion visitors are likely to appreciate the most. At present, however, the captain is free to get on with the game, without interference during the actual progress of the match. Only in the management of the nation's political and economic life is the principle of leadership ignored for the good or bad reason, the democratic government endeavouring to govern in the interests of the whole would step so severely on the corns of the particular section of the whole which gave them power, that the resultant outcry would see them driven helter-skelter from office. Thus governments of this order stand for the negation of leadership and are condemned always to follow abjectly at their master's feet. Equally miserable is the plight of the ordinary parliamentarian, who on the one hand dares not disobey his party whips, and on the other is scared stiff of saying or doing the slightest thing which might alienate any group of supporters in his constituency, no matter how small the group or how strong his conviction, should he ever possess a conviction, which is rare. No wonder that the fake leaders who arise in such circumstances are those best versed in the arts of compromise, camouflage, and all the multitudinous devices of low cunning. The one fortunate piece of revelation provided by our obsolete parliamentary system is that the people of Britain show, at election time, a very deep and earnest desire for leadership, no matter how woefully perverted the expression of it may be. For a few brief weeks, the candidate is cheered and acclaimed almost as a superman. The roof and crown of popular desire he may be, and frequently is, a plausible and self-seeking rascal, but that does not prevent his sublimation by the electorate into the embodiment and supreme objective of their hopes. This shows very clearly that when the mask is torn from the eyes of Britons so that they see how a sham leadership has utterly abused their trust, they will be aroused to stupendous heights of enthusiasm and inspired to great endeavour by the advent of a real leader who has the courage, the ability, and the vision to cut a path for them through the tangled growths of corruption and decay which at present hem them in and isolate them from the decency and grandeur of life. If there is to be discerned in the black shirts an immeasurable confidence, it is because we know that such a leader has already come among us, because we have looked for him in the eye and fear no more for the future of our race. Here, in the heart of the Empire's capital, a spectacle of fire. Fire which runs and leaps and turns, twinkling somersaults, providing the illuminations of the greatest of all the cities of the world. Not a raging, capricious fire that serves no human purpose, but a fire schooled by modern magicians to spell out messages to the imperial peoples who go their ways in the brilliance of the London night. Well might your Martian visitor find his astonishment at the spectacle swallowed by a feverish desire to know what mighty tidings are being flashed into the eyes and minds of men. The solution to the riddle of the universe would certainly be his first conjecture, for what lesser message could warrant the employment of letters of flame which once blazoned forth heaven's laws for the governance of earth? Pitiful conjecture, falling far short of the resplendent truth. There shall not be shortage of scornful tutors to put the Martian right. He is to be told that mankind has risen above all cosmic mysteries, that its aspirations and fears and achievements have been caught up and trained upon a still more transcendental objective, the commercial civilization deluxe, in which men are destined to become even more in tune with the infinite as their profits accumulate and their redundant souls decay. The custodians of the modern world, faithful to their trust, will not allow mankind to be sold for a mere abstraction or to waste its precious time upon foolish thoughts of good and ill. They serve a reality and serve it with unfaltering faithfulness until they die, the reality of dividends. Man has been defined as a thinking animal, a praying animal, an implement-using animal, as every kind of animal under the sun. But these definitions have obscured the one dazzling truth, that man is a buying animal. It is to the credit of our contemporary civilization, not only that this truth has been remembered, but that it has been burnt into the memory of our times by all the flaming messages of fire which gallop post-haste and as proud as cavalry to the eye from every vantage point in the city. Only a simpleton would have the human intelligence to beat the desert air by inquiring into the barren mysteries of eternity. Does he not know that there is truly majestic knowledge to be gained in the here and now? As an instance, does he not know that Brown's is the stout to shout about? The priest of old called upon the faithful to pray, the enlightened priests of today, the splendid hierarchy of those who sell, call with a louder voice upon the faithful, demanding that they should buy, and the ancient ritual of flame is again invoked, now to utter the larger truth that Brown's is the stout, to shout about. No doubt, in course of time, the imperial peoples will take up the mystic chant, pouring forth their sacrifices at the feet of Mr. Brown. Meanwhile, they walk the streets, impressed by the whirling pageantry of fire, feeling that in some way they too are initiates of the great commercial mysteries. If many of them are conscious of their small purchasing power, which makes their sacrifices to the priests so unworthy, they do not lack for compensation. Arcadia remains for their visiting. Some migrate for the evening from the modified rusticity of Camberwell Green to the wide open spaces of Hyde Park, where the summons of the lights may be forgotten as they hold their partners' hands and allow the lilt of American love croons to command a brief space of their lives, their sentimental simulacrum of sex, policed and kept respectable by the unceasing vigilance of the law. Others escape the blaze of the streets by paying for admission to temples where the lights are sympathetic and suffused, and where the potential he-men among them may gallop by proxy upon the backs of magnificent stallions to the rescue of prairie maidens in distress, while the potential she-women in fancy swoon beneath the brave beards of desert sheiks, mercifully divorced from their desert smells. Yet to the sensitive of nostril, there will be another smell, even less to the nose's pleasure. And next morning, before the imperial peoples set forth to work for their priests, for they must work as well as buy, the penny paper arrives with further supplies of narcotic in the shape of the world's sensations, assiduously garnered by telephone and wireless, flanked by the announcements of the indefatigable priests whose cosmic destiny it is to sell, 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 and at night, again, the blaze of sacred fires leaping upon the walls of the city. This is the freedom of the people, freed from their landscape and their soil, from their tradition and their heritage, from personality and from life. And in return for this freedom, they serve as slaves, the high priests of commerce and of usury, whose fathers did not fight at Agincourt. For a time only, they are not as yet dead, they can still comprehend a fire that refuses to blazon upon the wall the flaming message that Browns is the stout to shout about. It is a fire that glows within them, and which one day shall leap insurgent to its revenge, the fire that is the soul of Britain. Before the day dawns, the priests who befoul the spectacle of our life should have their portmanteau packed and waiting in the hall. You will remember when the troopship plunged upon its way across the channel, and the evening winds played a game of rough and tumble with your hair, how you gazed straight ahead, fearless-eyed, not only upon the adventure destined to engulf you, but upon a time when the lives of men should be as heroic as their deaths. Standing there, on the deck, the inexorable doom of battle brought nearer with every breath, you saw before you the vision of a future that held no place for the sordid futilities of the past, a future sanctified by the blood-caked agony of the fields of France and dedicated for all time to the noblest aspirations of your race. Looking back upon the wreckage of the years we contemplate, not alone the organized betrayal of your cause, but the hideous, calculated cynicism by means of which it is encompassed. To your memory, they raised the cenotaph, but the future of your vision they did not build. Your sacrifice, a paltry million lives, was not spectacular enough to ensure that your spirit's splendour should be caught up and enshrined in the life of the nation which you saved. Such a course would have involved sacrifice on the part of the masters of the situation, the political pundits and the lords of business, and you would be lacking in respect to men of such high consequence if you were to expect from them even the smallest surrender of their dues. You laid down your lives, it is true, but what was your purpose if not to ensure that there should still be profits and that political power should continue sweet for those privileged to taste of its fruit? Sleep on, brave comrades, it is well that the last sounds to reverberate through your mortal consciousness were the thunder of the barrage and the racket of the machine guns, for therein was a nobler music than the jackal cries of those who came to consolidate the peace and to batten on its gains. It is well that you did not see the cohesive purpose fade, the comradeship dissolve, and the yellow streak, burgeoning in a coat of many gorgeous colours, arise to take command. It is well, most assuredly it is well, that you did not watch your native land transformed as if by magic into a sort of monstrous palais de danse, with every species of commercial ramp finding a partner amidst every assortment of political graft, and kicking gleeful heels in the air to celebrate the debasement and vulgarization of life to levels upon which the lords and masters could not fail to feel at home. What of us, your brothers in arms? Does no reproach rest upon us? that we should have stood by while every value that we prized was derisively flung away or else dangled in front of us by self-seekers and cynics who had no purpose beyond exploiting our allegiance for other ends than ours. We can only say that we were young and scattered, and pathetically trustful of leaders who made bright promises to us, and who under cover of those promises served but one aim, at all costs, to keep themselves in power. It was long before we discovered that in order to achieve this result, there was no policy of compromise or surrender to which these leaders would refuse to stoop. On the one hand, we were offered a tawdry patriotism, a call not to build a finer, cleaner Britain, but to keep an ignoble Britain in a state of patchwork repair, and to conserve all that was mean and grasping and economically wicked, so that the wealth and privilege of the few might still survive. On the other hand, they offered us a greasy internationalism, the class war, the dictatorship of the proletariat, and all the other distempers of the socialist dream. As these two alternatives drew together, and arranged marriages of convenience, we found ourselves still farther in the darkness, and for the most part became resigned to what seemed the inevitable defeat of our once virile and majestic race. If the records ended here, they would make but sorry reading, but they do not end here. When our need was the most urgent and our position the most hopeless, we were amazed to see emerging from a miscellany of fake leaders a leader who was not a fake. He was of our own war companionship. He saw as we saw and felt as we felt, only with an intense luminosity. He called upon the crusade. He called upon us to follow him in a drive against the largest and the most strongly entrenched social conspiracies the world has ever known. He called upon us to destroy the organized sham that masqueraded as our national life. He called upon us to put aside our doubts, to relinquish our case, and once again to take up the hard fight for Britain, this time to save her soul. Inspired by his dauntless courage, animated by the power of his personality, and impelled by the superb vigour of his mind, we hastened to respond, one by one, score by score, hundred by hundred, and then thousand by thousand, so that today the thunder of our march, side by side with the flower of the nation's youth, has sounded throughout the land. In the strength of our creed, we shall pass triumphantly through ridicule, abuse, and violence to liberate the people of our nation from the shoddy tyrannies which oppress and corrupt them, and to set before them an ideal of service to their country such as they have never known before. We are the fascists of Britain. We come upon the national scene as challengers of every factor that spells decay. We challenge the notion that men must of necessity live far below the level of their own transcendent achievement. We challenge profit-mongers and the promoters of class war, and bid them give way before our cause. We plan for a united nation in which there shall be wealth and equity for all. There is no room for any other plan, no place for any other cause. We carry with us, as a sacred possession, the memory of the spirit which flamed in you when you leapt upon death as an athlete upon the ball. If human endeavour avail, that flame shall serve as a beacon to irradiate the hearts of Britons through many years to come, and to shine forth across the seas as an assurance to her sons and daughters that the mother country, resurgent and vital, has again assumed the lead in the vanguard of the mighty nations of the world.
It's Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.